The next case is 97-2039 and 98-834, East Canton Education Association versus John McIntosh, and State Expo John McIntosh versus Offenburg Local School District.
Never was joined by the parties. suspect it never came into existence. Mr. McIntosh may have been eligible for a continuing contract, but he certainly never participated in the ultimate formation of that contract. Now, he did not form a continuing contract in Arlington. He did not serve under that contract, and when he ultimately was employed by Osliver Hansen, he could not reference or refer back to Marlinson as a predicate for claiming that he had continuing service in Hansen with his contract.
Back to the procedural issue, if the notice of appeal is in fact premature, didn't it mature?
It did not.
Is there anything left standing now?
The only thing left standing now is an appeal from the January 23rd judgment of the trial court. The August 22nd judgment was a non-final order from which no appeal could be taken. Had the trial court utilized the magic 54B, no just reason for delay language, that appeal, once filed prematurely by Mr. McIntosh, may have been subject to appellate rule 4C and may have matured when the trial court issued its decision on January 23rd. However, after the 54B, the required 54B language, that judgment was non-final, and since no appeal was taken from that judgment, after January 23rd, 1997, the trial court's judgment on those issues, the third-party complaint and the county claim, in fact, became final and non-appealable.
Well, maturity just doesn't take place vis-a-vis 54B language. It could be that there's no filing of the journal entry.
It could be. There could be no filing.
And therefore, you file a notice of appeal. It's not appealable then, but it matures. Isn't that what happened here? I mean, it doesn't have anything to do with 54B language. You can't make final and appealable through 54B what isn't.
You can't
make a silk purse out of a sow's ear.
I agree that may not be done. But the order appealed from must in fact be a final order, and it must be an order that is journalized and entered on the docket of the court.
If that's the case, then you'd never have, that would 54B language would be applicable, which you'd never have a notice of appeal filed properly unless everything was finished, unless there was a journal entry. And a lot of times we used to see a journal entry not yet filed. Two cases ago, we had it here today. Same thing. You see the notice of appeal filed. If by the time you look at it, it has matured, then you accept it. Otherwise, you dismiss it. Didn't this mature?
This is a judgment by the trial court on the counterclaim and the third-party complaint. When we analyze and test that judgment under 2505-02, that's a final order. But all the claims of all the parties were not finally adjudicated. That, I believe, is a significant difference.
But they are now.
The claims regarding tenure are finally adjudicated, and the claims regarding Mr. McIntosh's defamation allegations against the board are adjudicated and subject to appeal. It's our position that no appeal was taken from the trial court's August 22nd judgment, although that could have been a final judgment because it determined the action as far as McIntosh's defamation claim against my appellant's party. But the 54B language is attached, which would have permitted him to file that appeal, even though remaining claims against other parties or the same party remain pending before the trial court. That's the difference. All of McIntosh's claims with respect to defamation and tortious interference in the contract were adjudicated by the trial court. But all of the claims of all of the parties were not adjudicated. That activates 54B. And the trial court did not attach that language to its entry. Therefore, it was not a final order pursuant to 54B, which was subject to appellate review.
I guess my problem is, Mr. McConnell, if you do that, then in this particular case, and I'm usually a stickler on the 54B, and I've written a number of those cases, but here, if we reverse on the procedural issue, you go back, then you file the notice of appeal, because everything's been done.
We believe the order was non-final, and he can't became final on January 23rd, he did not file the notice of appeal from the August 22nd judgment. Absent an appeal from that judgment, he referenced only the January 23rd judgment.
Yeah, I understand. So what you're going to say is that he's out of court, or, he's out of court because he didn't file a timely notice of appeal when the Court of Appeals has already said it matured. So we're going to prejudice him by what the court said.
Well,
I don't mean necessarily prejudice him. We're going to penalize him for what the Court of Appeals did, assuming your argument is right. Isn't that where it comes out?
Oh, I don't believe he's being prejudiced. Mr. McIntosh, as we were required to do at the invitation of the Court of Appeals, had to review the issue of whether or not this was a final order. We did that at the invitation of the Court of Appeals, and we concluded that the Court of Appeals suggested that this was not a final order. Now, the Court of Appeals ultimately...
Sure, they said it was.
That it was a final order based upon Huffer and based upon their analysis of Appellate Rule 4C, we respectfully submit to this court that the Court of Appeals was wrong.
You want to discuss the private public figure issue, or is your colleague?
Mr. Ross is going to do that. I believe my time has expired.
Thank you, Mr. McCullough. Mr. Ross.
Thank you, Mr. Court. My name is Richard Ross. I represent the Office of Local School District Board of Education and individual members at the time. This case arose and the superintendent at the time this case arose. I may refer to them as the education, Board of Education parties for state
of. Is there any superintendent in Ohio, maybe elsewhere, is there any superintendent in Ohio not involved in controversy, not a public figure? Are all superintendents public figures?
I believe under the ruling of this court that due to status as a superintendent, that a superintendent in the state of Ohio would be a public figure.
Okay. Now, why do we move principals to that elevated status?
Because if you look at the responsibilities of a building principal and the duties that a building principal performs, he is the person who actually operates and runs that building. The public looks to him for information about the operation of that building. The news media looks to him for information about the operation of that building. He exercises discretion about the operation of that building.
I don't mean to be facetious, but do you know who the principal of the school located in your neighborhood is?
Oh, absolutely.
Do you have children in that school?
Yes.
Hmm. Would somebody else not know?
I live in a very small community, so I would guess that most of the people in my community know. If you're talking about the city of Columbus, I would guess that a substantial portion of people in the city of Columbus probably cannot identify the superintendent of the city of Columbus. So the notoriety of the individual, I don't believe is a question for us. I think that you have to look at the function of the job as opposed to the person in terms of being a public figure due to the status of that person. There's also a second element where someone can be a public figure for a limited purpose.
In interjecting themselves into a matter of public concern and controversy.
For the purpose of affecting that decision. And I believe that also is the case here, which subjects Mr. McIntosh to the level of review that a public figure has.
What did you think is your stronger argument? What do you think is your stronger argument here in this case? Do we have to find that every principal is a public official or a public person?
I think the court could choose here if it wanted to find that due to the notoriety that Mr. McIntosh enjoyed in terms of injecting himself into this controversy, requesting that all proceedings of the public be quoted in the newspaper, that the court could rule that based upon those activities, he injected himself into this controversy and thus became a public figure without even deciding the second issue, which would mean that all principals in the state of Ohio would not be public figures under the decision of this case. That's how it came out. Well, if you find he is not a public figure, it won't change the outcome as far as the Court of Appeals is concerned, but we believe the Court of Appeals missed a major issue here. And we would point to the decision of the trial court, which wrestled with this case for
don't even have to reach the public figure now.
Quasi-judicial proceeding. If it's a quasi-judicial proceeding, anything uttered or filed therein is privileged.
That may be the case under that analysis, not the official meeting analysis, but the quasi-judicial analysis. I guess I don't know that limitation that I mentioned that arises out of a matter pending before the body exists. I can't recall. I don't know the issues that are addressed by the court to discuss the quasi-judicial analysis.
Are you claiming the school board is sovereignly immune under Chapter 2744?
Absolutely not. We're arguing that the Board of Education superintendent enjoy the absolute privilege, which is a judicially created privilege by the court to
This applies to the members of the school board, and they're privileged. It's a quasi-judicial proceeding because they're deciding something. Is Mr. McCullough's, Mr. McCullough's people also privileged?
They were not. If they were participating as witnesses or as, they were participating as opponents of one side or the other,
they're in the proceeding. Regardless of whose side they're on, they're in the proceeding, aren't they?
Well, I think I would try to draw a distinction between someone who may be just in the audience and says something versus someone who's actually participating in the inquiry that's before the board and presenting information to the board. If they are presenting information to the board, similarly as any counsel presenting information to the court, then I believe they would be protected by that.
And you can see where that argument might go. Where I was going with it is, are you uncomfortable in this case sitting on the same side of the table with Mr. McCullough? Yeah, for sure.
The last item I will leave you for is, in this instance, they're going to issue a publication of the defamation case. We believe that the evidence shows clearly that any of the defamatory statements were published by Mr. McCullough here, not the Board of Education.
Thank you, Mr. Ross. Mr. Zimmerman.
Chief Justice, good morning, and please report. My name is Brian Zimmerman, and I have the privilege of representing John McIntosh, the athlete in this case. As a procedural matter, Mr. McCullough introduced himself as representing the Ohio Education Association. They are no longer a part of this case. They were voluntarily dismissed by the plaintiffs in order to limit.
Why didn't you appeal that first ruling?
Your Honor, I did appeal that. I appealed immediately within 30 days after the first ruling, and that was because in my original case, that was in a separate court, that bothered me. I had filed a declaratory judgment action. It was the same action that had already been filed subsequently by the
Was it a final appealable order at that point?
I wasn't sure, and that's why I filed the appeal to protect my client's interest, and the Court of Appeals did not get to my case or to that first appeal until after all of the cases had been decided, and they asked whether the case was final before them, and under 4C, or proposal 4C, it was a premature notice of appeal that license after the remaining issues were disclosed.
How do you respond to your adversary's contention that since you didn't appeal the subsequent ruling, 4C gets defined?
It would almost be like lying and waving the bushes. Mr. McCullough never raised the issue of not a final appeal of order. He never raised it. The Court of Appeals was first addressed that. It was a mere technicality.
You know, it would be at the point when all of the issues then were before the court.
And the final order would expire. And the Court of Appeals said no, it wasn't final and sent back. There was all the time that would have been done. It was a mere technicality. And I think that's what 4C speaks to. It says after the announcement of the pending decision. It doesn't say after the announcement of a final decision. Mr. McCullough put it in his brief that it specifically says only final announcements can be appealed. But with the flux that goes on a final appealable order decision, it's now clear on what's final and
flux presented by the court, you mean? Or
No.
Thank you.
Not from the court. But it's always been flux. I'm never quite sure what is final. And to protect my client, I have to act prudently and file a notice. And perhaps I should have filed a second one, but the law now requires the company filing an unnecessary thing.
Thank you.
Notice Mr. McIntosh is charged with
proceeding before the school.
Absolutely not. Absolutely not.
I mean, the gravamen of what you posted.
Right. They would know the reason they were well before the school board meeting about the health reason for 2 days or 3 days later. And then it was at that time that Mr. McIntosh.
Do you disagree or agree that anything that is stated in an official proceeding with respect to removing your client from the employer of school district would be privileged?
I think qualified privilege. Absolutely qualified privilege, but then again, it all comes down to, because if you have absolute privilege for any kind of board meeting, a superintendent under any kind of limited contract, even like a teacher who has a limited contract, a janitor, he could walk into a board meeting and make the most outrageous statement, as he did in this case, against that teacher. And that's a, well, what is other contract on? We're not going to give you a chance.
Yeah, and the argument you just presented to us indicates that you feel that you have a case that should get to a jury outside the confines of what was said in an official board meeting or official meeting.
Absolutely. There were school board even sent another spokesman to remain somewhat neutral. They were sending out letters to the entire community, to every home in the community, stating that Mr. McIntosh was immoral, stating that Mr. McIntosh had to be forcibly removed from the school because he couldn't control student behavior and he refused voluntary relief. None of it was true. And they all admitted none of those people. And that's why, with respect to the public figure and public official analysis, the one thing that cuts through that is the showing of actual evidence. And the record before this court will indicate with clear and convincing evidence that there is actual malice in the publication. They did this to destroy Mr. McIntosh.
You don't care whether he's a public figure or a private figure in this case.
No, technically, I do not. I mean, I agree with the Court of Appeal. Both of them agree that he's a private figure.
Yeah. I want to follow up on what Justice Pfeiffer said, because I was concerned about that. If you're not concerned about what went on, no. If your cause of action is not primarily based on what went on in the school board meeting, then doesn't that let the Education Association out?
Absolutely not.
Didn't Ms. Flick, or whatever her name was, didn't she make her statement at the meeting?
Well, what Mary Jo Flick did at the meeting was the teacher had authorized the usual statement. Mary Jo Flick prepared a statement.
Yes.
And blasted Mr. McIntosh. That is not entitled to qualified immunity. That was excessive publication. There was no reason for her to get up in front of. I mean, you have to picture the setting of hundreds of people.
So at least part of your complaint is based on what went on at the meeting.
Yes.
As opposed to.
Qualified privilege. I do believe that, but under Ponzi Thompson, this court's decision is honest. If there's malice, there's a showing of actual malice, we can overcome that. And this record is littered with actual malice.
Has there been a determination of that issue? There's been no determination whether there's actual malice or not.
The Court of Appeals have all decided that there are genuine issues of material fact regarding all of them, of whether there was actual malice. We believe that there was sufficient evidence to find that there was actual malice. When the superintendent admitted, I didn't have any evidence to support an immorality charge, and I'm still charging you with that. When the school board representative stands up at the school board meeting and said, we don't believe Mr. McIntosh is immoral in the common sense, but we do believe that he is immoral in the legal sense, what does that mean? The public is roughly expressing that he is indeed immoral, especially in today's society where teachers and principals are being arrested all the time for illicit and improper conduct with their students. And it's happening all the time again. We see these in the newspaper, and that's what the impression was left to the public.
Is it your position that he is not a public figure? I understand your ambivalence about it. But if he is not a public figure because he didn't interject himself, he was interjected.
Absolutely. They created the controversy. They created the media frenzy. Obviously, when you look at some of these articles and read through some of these newspaper articles, you'll see Mr. McIntosh was contacted by the media until after the superintendent and school board first spoke to them. And that's where it all started. The superintendent and school board are giving reasons to the newspaper why they want to not renew him, even before they meet with Mr. McIntosh.
At the end of the day, they have a right to non-renew him.
Absolutely.
Okay. So do we have then have to also decide the secondary issue that he is a tenured teacher?
Absolutely.
All right. How do we, if this goes back, as Justice Pfeiffer was indicating to you, if it goes back, where are you? Are the cases from the 5th and the 7th District now consolidated for trial if it goes back?
Yes, sir.
So that you'd go, you'd be after them for a declaration that he's a tenured teacher, even if he's properly non-renewed, and the defamation from either or both. I got it.
Let me stop this. I want to make sure I understand your test for determining whether somebody's a public figure. Does the person have to want to be or insert himself or herself into the public arena, so to speak, or can they be by the nature of their job, number one, or by the nature of the conduct that creates the entire event, creates a status of public figure? So it seems to me that this isn't entirely up to the person to decide whether or not by their conduct that he or she is a public figure, but that events can cause them to be.
I think that's a Gertz decision, and it's my understanding that a public figure is one who involuntarily interjects himself, promotes himself into the forefront of the conflict. I think with a public figure, there is some control by the person who claims that they were defending. On the other side, I believe that the public official, the question is, what is their importance in the government position? And I believe
in this case, frankly, that we have to go that far. It seems to me, in this case, the question is whether Mr. McIntosh is a public figure, and what are the factors that we look to determine whether he's a public figure. Is it entirely based upon his desire, or not his desire, but his conduct alone? Do we look at his conduct alone, the fact he didn't seek out a newspaper reporter and all this sort of thing, or do we look at the events that created the situation in which he finds himself, in which he participates.
I think it's the latter. I think that your focus has to be on what occurred, how it occurred, and how he found the first guy to come from Mr. McIntosh. Because he wasn't a villain. And I believe when the court reviews that, we'll see that in the school board who made the controversy, it's not me. And the school board is also the one that created the media frenzy. Thank you. reference to that.
Does the trial court have the tenure issue in front of it?
Yes, sir.
And that's the one that went to the 7th District?
Yes, sir.
And the 7th District affirms that he is a tenured teacher?
Correct.
So, for us to change that, we would have to reverse specifically what those two courts ruled.
Correct.
All right, so when this goes back, you're really going to try it on the defamation business, if it goes back, if we don't reverse it and enter a final judgment. You're going to try it on the defamation issues, and whether he wins or loses on that, he still would be a tenured teacher. Okay? Were there a couple of issues at the trial court that you lost on?
Well, there were a lot of issues.
All right. Yeah, I know. And you appealed those?
Yes.
Is there a cross appeal here?
No, there's no cross appeal.
Right. So you are just in the position now of arguing, affirm the 7th District on the tenure issue, and affirm the trial court and the 5th District on the issues for trial vis-a-vis both parties on defamation. Let's sum it up.
If I may,
just very quickly.
Yeah.
And I'm the one that appealed all the decisions that went up to the court.
Yeah.
And in closing, I would simply ask the court to please allow Mr. McIntosh the ability to finally return to clear his good name in front of the jury so that he may get on with his life. And I thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Recall, Mr. Ross, one of you gets rebuttal, so you've chosen.
If I may,
chose, good.
Mr. Ross.
Sure.
What Mr. Zimmerman has failed to tell the court is that he permitted the reporters to enter the high school building to interview students, to take pictures of students. He permitted reporters in his home to take pictures of him being served with a copy of the termination notice effectuated by the Board of Education. As far as my mind.
Well, if he hadn't done that, he'd been accused of hiding something. That's what the press does with us.
Well,
me.
I don't want to equate the Mr. McIntosh to dishonorable court. What I believe the evidence here that this court has to grasp is that as far as my clients were concerned, the defamatory statement was uttered during a formal proceeding. If it was a quasi-judicial proceeding, I submit to the court that absolute immunity attaches. If it were not a quasi-judicial proceeding and a formal proceeding of the Board of Education, then a qualified immunity must attach, a qualified privilege exists. These two individuals were acting clearly within the scope of their employment. Mr. McIntosh had accused their members of failing to appropriately discipline students. He did that in the newspaper. That was his voluntary act. These two individuals were before the Board of Education taking the position that this board should permit the process to work. We're here to see that the process works. Don't be consumed by public displays and public outcry. The law gives you the right to deal with Mr. McIntosh. If he's correct, the law will exonerate him. That's all my client said. If this court accepts the position of Mr. McIntosh, every time a public school teacher or even a public employee is proposed for discipline or termination, counsel for that employee is going to be required to file a parallel lawsuit for defamation. That's going to happen. If we don't do that, we're probably committing malpractice. Every time a public employee is proposed for termination, a collateral defamation lawsuit will have to be filed, simply because that employer lifted the statutory language, immorality, out of the statute and said, we propose to discipline you or discharge you. One of the bases is immorality.
What is the... That's not true.
Clearly, Mr. McIntosh in this case is a public figure. Clearly, the utterances by my client were opinions and views of the association, thus protected by Section 11 of Article 1. Clearly, there was a privilege that attached to the proceedings before the Board of Education. To now transform all of that into an action for defamation will turn our system.
system of public employee, public employer labor relations on its head. We're going to have a system of defamation actions now. We're going to invite every public employee who is proposed for discipline, termination, or discharge to now file suit against the employer, the public employer, and allege tortious interference with contract and defamation. That's going to be the message.
Well, that's what you like, then. I'd like to hear something on the other issue, some of the other issue of whether or not I assume that's not
true. That is my issue. That is my issue. I filed a declaratory judgment action. This is clearly set forth in the brief that I provided. There are three situations where acceptance of a continuing contract is presumed. Mr. McIntosh and his counsel can't apparently understand the fact that those three predicates don't exist in this case.
He lost his trial on the one before the appeal.
He won at the Court of Appeals.
But lost his trial.
So the Court of Appeals ruled in his favor, and the trial court ruled in his favor. We appealed that judgment. The Court of Appeals did not reverse the trial court. The fact of the matter still remains three factual scenarios, predicates that activate the presumption of acceptance do not exist in this case. They do not exist. Mr. McIntosh was required to take some affirmative action demonstrating and establishing that he accepted a continuing contract of employment. He did not do that. He did nothing. He didn't sign a contract. He didn't say, I'll be there. He didn't even call.
In the statute, I didn't see that. Where is the statute?
Section 3319.
Well, what are the exact words that were indicated against the Donald Trump step?
In Section 3319.08.
If somebody would, I recall the word saying that if there's no rejection given, it is presumed that he's accepting it.
If the court examines Section 3319.8, it will find the language that recites this. If a Board of Education elects to issue a limited or continuing contract and the teacher accepts such contract, then the failure to enter a written contract will not avoid that contract relationship. Then one might examine Section 3319.11. Those are the presumption of acceptance scenarios. They don't exist in this case, Your Honor. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Well, the case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion. Take your recess.
All rise.